War's hell. People are going to get hurt in the war. But the idea is to win a war as quick as you can do it. World War I used gases of one type or another. Mustard gas burned people just as badly and had just as bad effect as radiation burns. Because they saw what happened after World War I, it was generally agreed by the Geneva Conventions that those gases would not be used. Heck, you drop firebombs on people with phosphorus in them, you burn them up. What's the difference?
We had been briefed not to go through any cloud because it would probably be radioactive. And we're all concerned, we're all young men, and we're concerned about some of us were married, someday we might be married, someday we might want to have children, and we didn't want the radiation to have any effect on reproduction systems. We didn't know enough about radiation. We didn't even know much about it, but that we knew. It was okay, because since then, my wife and I had 10 children, and they were all well, thank God.
When I think of Hiroshima, I think of my personal reaction here in Chicago. One of, I'm sorry to say, elation. I had no idea. None of us did, I suppose, except those who worked on it. Perhaps those who had more of an active conscience than most of us did. I says, God, the war is over. And the war now is over. VJ Day matches VE Day. Without realizing, it took a while to realize the horrendousness of the bomb and its effect. As any number says, it was dropped on women and children primarily. And the question today always comes up. Was the dropping of the bomb, the atom bomb on Hiroshima, and then, of course, to compound it all 3 days later on Nagasaki, were those two trips necessary? There was a phrase during World War II, to save gasoline. Is this trip necessary, when you're traveling? Ask yourself. If you're patriotic and want to help the Allies win the war and beat Hitler and Tojo and Mussolini, is this trip necessary? And so I ask today about those two trips, one over Hiroshima, one over Nagasaki. Were those trips necessary?
A short time ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima and destroyed its usefulness to the enemy. That bomb has more power than 20,000 tons of TNT. The Japanese began the war from the air at Pearl Harbor. They have been repaid many fold. It is an atomic bomb. It is a harnessing of the basic power of the universe.
Following the atomic bombings of Hiroshima, a group of professional dancers who'd survived came together to share what they'd experienced. They called themselves the Hiroshima Dancers.
Of course, a lot of the people who experienced the bombing are, disappearing. And it is definitely the fact that the whole memory is beginning to fade.
It was to be 7 years before the public saw the completed work, because artistic expression based on the atomic bombings was restricted by the American occupation.
This piece depicts the various types of suffering, especially his close family and close friends had to endure after the bombing. For example, many of young girls became really ugly. They're, what we call keloids. Well, one act of the piece depicts how she cannot enjoy, being a youthful girl, her suffering. Then another part depicts how all of a sudden a radiation disease can attack a healthy person, even, years after the event.
Remember, we were blindfolded, hands were tied behind.
When the Americans bombed Hiroshima, they didn't know that at least 10 U.S. flyers were held there. Walter Ross, his B-29, called the Nip Clipper, was hit by flak. He and the crew bailed out into the Sea of Japan, and they were captured, taken to Hiroshima 10 days after the bombing.
We found out that Ralph was on a B-24 plane that had come out of Okinawa.
It was then that Walter Ross saw another American, Ralph Neal. Neal was dying from the effects of the atomic bomb.
Just remember it so plain how their mouths were constantly open. They never seemed to close their mouths, and they said flies and bugs could freely crawl in and out, and they made no attempt to, to brush them aside. They were just there. And you could see pus coming out of their ears. It was very difficult for them to talk and to communicate. And they were dirty. They were just hardly living, really. And we didn't really know what kind of injuries they had. I say again, we did not know that this was an atomic bomb. We just knew it was some kind of a bomb had been dropped there. We didn't know anything about radiation and radiation poisoning and that sort of thing.
When the ceasefire was declared a week or so after the bomb, it was obvious that the American scientists, the American military, the project, would want to know a great deal about what was happening at the other end, at the target end. And it was also a medical problem.
Physicist Philip Morrison was sent to the bomb cities with a group of scientists from Tinian Island to undertake an initial survey of the results of the bombings.
Inspecting party to Japan pretty soon. We talked a little bit to Japanese scientists. I remember very well a well-known radiologist, Professor Suzuki, who was the only person I met in all of Japan who carried towards the Americans a certain sense of animosity and expressed animosity, which was what I expected, but nobody else did. But he came to us very ironically. He showed the experiments he had done in the University of Pennsylvania long before the war, which he radiated whole-body radiation of dogs and recorded what happened to their blood and all those things. And he said, oh, I said, but these are nothing, just a few dogs, but you Americans, you have carried out a human experiment. This is a bitterly ironic and brilliant remark, which really set me back. I admired him intensely.
Had you carried out a human experiment?
We had, of course. We had that perhaps intended to, but that's what we did.
I hold in my hand at this moment a copy of the Oak Ridge Journal. Oak Ridge, one of the places where the bomb was made. And the date is Thursday, August 9th, 1945. 3 days after the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. And the very day it was dropped on Nagasaki, though the journalists on this paper didn't know about Nagasaki. Oak Ridge Journal, and the headline is August 9th, 1945. Workers thrill as atomic bomb secret breaks. It's a triple line headline, the second part of the headline. Press and radio stories describe fantastically powerful weapon expected to save many lives.
No other news has, or perhaps can, surmount that of the new atomic bomb announced yesterday. So today, we're going to bring you stories and reactions concerning
the way you did at the American canteens with a tin tray. And the radio is going on. There was talk on the radio. I could get to, above all the din and the clatter of the cups and the trays, that some enormous new thing had happened, some big bomb. And I asked the man who was doling out the food, what's going on? What's the news? What's the scoop, which was the term we used in those days? They're going on about some great new bomb they've dropped on Japan, a place called Hiroshima or somewhere. And won't make any difference to us here. They said it's going to shorten the war. Won't make any difference to us here.
Australian journalist Wilfred Burchett was on his way to cover the final assault on Japan. 3 weeks after the Hiroshima bombing, Burchett landed in Japan with the first wave of American occupation forces. 250 war correspondents prepared to record the surrender on the battleship Missouri in Tokyo Bay. One man did not. Wilfred Burchett feigned illness, broke through General MacArthur's security to board a civilian train for Hiroshima, 400 miles distant.
Every time the train stopped, I kept repeating the question, Konoeki wa nante desu? What is the name of this station? And eventually, after 22 hours, almost exactly after leaving Tokyo, the reply came, Hiroshima.
Wilfred Burchett got to Hiroshima before a group of hand-picked journalists known as the Occupation Press Corps. Among that group was William Lawrence of the New York Times, born in Lithuania, educated at Harvard. William Lawrence was especially selected by General Leslie Groves, the man in charge of the bomb project, to visit and write about the secret war plants. He'd write a series of reports following the use of the bombs. After the war, William Lawrence appeared with Bob Hope in this presentation describing the atomic bomb.
Bill Lawrence's story with you.
It wasn't really my story. It was man's story. And perhaps the biggest news story of the 20th century. I was privileged to be tapped on the shoulder by the Army and given the assignment that every newspaper man dreams of.
Mr. Lawrence, we want you to work for us for a few months. It'll be on a highly secret, and it'll be a very important program.
The general was Leslie R. Groves of the Corps of Engineers.
We can't tell you where you're going. All we can say is that you come to Washington and start to work. It's an important story. It's a story that we only want one man working on, and you are the man.
Well, needless to say, Bill, you accepted General
When William Lawrence got to Hiroshima for the biggest news story in the history of the world, he found Burchett already had it.
I went to a hospital which had survived in the outskirts of the city. These people were all in various states of physical disintegration. They would all die, but they were giving them whatever comfort could be given until they died. And the doctor explained that he didn't know why they were dying. The only symptoms they could isolate from a medical point of view was that of acute vitamin deficiency. So they started giving vitamin injections. And he explained that where they put the needle in, then the flesh started to rot. And then gradually the thing would develop this bleeding, which they couldn't stop, and then the hair falling out. And the hair falling out was more or less the last stage, and a number of the women were lying there with sort of halos of their black hair, which had already fallen out on the pillows.
Burchett transmitted his fantastic story to his Australian colleague, Bill Keyes, by Morse code. Keyes saw that the story got to London by telex for the September 5th edition of the London Daily Express. With Burchett's lead, "I write this as a warning to the world." By the time Lawrence got his report to the New York Times, it was 8 days later. His headline read, "No radioactivity in Hiroshima ruin."
I felt staggered, really staggered by what I'd seen. And just where I sat down, I found some lump of concrete, I remember, that had not been pulverized. I sat on that with my little Hermes typewriter. And my first words, I remember now, were, "I write this as a warning to the world."
General MacArthur withdrew Burchett's press accreditation. His camera, loaded with his historic pictures from Hiroshima, had disappeared from his bag. William Lawrence went on to win his second Pulitzer Prize for his 10-part New York Times series on the atomic bomb.
Leo, what's the trouble? Look at these bills, Fred. Leo, this is Japanese occupation money. I know, I'm loaded with it. I'm yen happy. Say, that's right. I read that you and Danny Kaye spent 2 months entertaining our boys in Japan. How was your trip?
Wonderful, Fred. We flew over 32,000 miles to Manila, Guam, Kwajalein, Okinawa, Yokohama, Tokyo, and Korea.
Say, did you see that city where the first atomic bomb was dropped?
Yes, Fred. We flew over Hiroshima for about half an hour.
It was a shambles, huh?
A shambles? It looked like Ebbets Field after a doubleheader with the Giants.
Well, what about that city where the second bomb landed, Nagasaki? You know that old song?
The end of World War II brought with it a massive change in the scientific landscape. Two bombs had made all the difference in the world. And now that it was public, weapons testing began in earnest with an accompanying barrage of publicity and Cold War justification. In January 1946, the Navy announced Operation Crossroads.
Let the natives express to the people of the United States their welcome. Despite the fact that the atoll of Bikini may be utterly destroyed come July the 1st.
Bikini Island, what is now called Micronesia, was the target. Its 167 residents were relocated by the Navy.
All right now, James, will you tell them that the United States government now wants to turn this great...
In this soundtrack from a government film, we hear U.S. Navy Commodore Ben Wyatt meeting beneath coconut trees beside a picturesque lagoon on Bikini Island.
How it will sound. 20 seconds. We do not know how it's going to sound, but 42,000 men here are watching.
Bikini Island would host the largest man-made explosion in history. Some years later, a hydrogen bomb, codenamed Bravo, would explode here with 1,000 times the force of the Hiroshima bomb and vaporize the entire test island and parts of two others, sucking them 20 miles into the tropic sky. Over the next 12 years, the United States tested almost 100 weapons in the Pacific.
From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, An iron curtain has descended across the continent.
In 1946, Winston Churchill, no longer Britain's Prime Minister, addressed this gathering at Westminster College, Missouri, President Harry Truman's alma mater. Winston Churchill's presentation was titled Sinews of Peace.
Vienna, Budapest, Belgrade, Bucharest, and Sofia. All these famous cities and the populations around them lie in what I must call the Soviet
sphere. Programs at this time to bring you a special news bulletin. President Truman has just announced that Soviet Russia has the atomic bomb. The announcement was made with dramatic...
Well, now you come to a new development, a new aspect, science and secrets. Science has no secrets. The scientists all tell you the secrets may be engineering, but not scientific. And, of course, the top scientists, Einstein and the others, and Niels Bohr, suggested, too, that all these discoveries be shared because they would find it anyway. The scientists of the world have a fraternity, a fraternal feeling. The idea of it being a science having secrets is sheer nonsense. Ask Philip Morrison about that. Don't ask me. Ask the scientists about it.
What did you tell the public?
By the end of 45, we had evolved a certain number of ideas in concert and had put these into slogan form. So it turns out these mottos or slogans are awfully good today, which I think is more than we could have expected after 40 years. And they said, first, there is no secret, which by which we were saying everyone will have this, in particular the Russians.
The Cold War was beginning to congeal. The Soviet Union had invaded Czechoslovakia. Berlin was under blockade. The communist Chinese were moving across China. Pressure grew enormously for Edward Teller's superbomb, a hydrogen bomb thousands of times more powerful than the bombs dropped on Japan. Testing moved to the mainland United States to Nevada, where it's still conducted today. The first nuclear detonation occurred there in 1951. A 1 kiloton bomb dropped from an Air Force plane onto Frenchman Flat, a desolate valley 65 miles northwest of Las Vegas.
Since 1951, these barren hills have echoed to 31 atomic detonations.
In the 50s, when I was a child, it was not a backdrop. The bombs went off in our backyard and rivaled the sunrise.
Mary Manning is a journalist at the Las Vegas Sun, where she's worked for most of her life.
Always, we'd see that purplish-orange burst in the air, and often see the pink clouds hovering over from the radioactive fallout. And we actually did our duck and cover drills in school, just like a fire drill, except you go under the desk and hide your head, to the blast. We used to time them to the blast of the jet fire. Those flashes in the sky have been burned into my brain forever. I won't get rid of them ever.
Duck and cover, he did what we all must learn to do. You and you and you and you. Duck and cover.
It was along about 1951 when the government first started this testing down in Nevada, and everyone around Cedar and Parowan that you talked to was really excited about it. It was really a big thing, big deal. And we thought that we was going to be part of the national defense and that we was going to be able to help out in some small way in developing the bombs. And we just felt a patriotic feeling towards our government that we was being of some use. Well, anyway,
Isaac Nelson is one of almost 5 million Mormons living in Utah, not far from the Nevada test site. He's retired, works as a security guard at the local police station in Cedar City, Utah. Isaac Nelson remembers the day atomic testing began in the United States.
Put up on top of these high towers, 300 or 400 or 500 feet in the air. I've never seen them, but I've read about them. And they would explode these above-ground bombs, and some of them they would drop the bombs out of airplanes. And these were the type of bombs, these above-ground bombs, were the ones that were picking up the dust from the desert floor, and they would go up and they would form this mushroom cloud, which in turn would form the radiation cloud, which would drift over St. George and Cedar and Panaca and Pioche and various communities here in southern Utah and Nevada. I recall that the people, when they first started these tests, were all really excited. In the morning that they had the first test, there was dozens of people who'd get in their car and they'd drive out west of town here, the other side of the stockyard, and walk up on the hillside, and they had a clear view across the valley for about 10, 15 miles. And we'd sit there huddled up early in the early morning, and along about 5 o'clock, why, that would be long before daylight, here would come this blast, and the whole sky would just light up with a red-orange flash. And if you'd have had newspaper there, you could have been able to read the newspaper by it. It was so brilliant, and still that bomb was exploded a good 100 miles, I guess, away from it.
Isaac Nelson recalls watching a fallout cloud from a bomb test slowly drift over Cedar City. His wife, Olita, was to die from a brain tumor. But before she did, Isaac recalled an incident that made him think fallout could be the cause of her slowly declining health.
That headache just kept reoccurring. But anyway, it went on for a period of, 3 weeks or a month or such a matter, and one day I was sitting in the living room. That was in another house before we built this one. And I was sitting in the living room, and she was in the bathroom washing her head. And all at once, she let out the most ungodly scream you could imagine. I couldn't imagine what was wrong with her, and I rushed in there, and her hair had slipped right off from about halfway back on her head and was in the wash basin. And she had just beautiful black, shiny hair. And it was just black. It just, when it was in the sun, it just glistened, just almost green like a raven's wing. It was beautiful hair, long hair. But you can imagine the reaction that a woman would have to lose all of her hair and see it there laying in the wash basin. And she was just in a state of panic.
During the 1950s, the public health dangers posed by radioactive fallout from test explosions in the atmosphere began to be appreciated. Scientists and doctors like Nobel Prize winner Linus Pauling applied pressure on the government.
Radioactive fallout causes damage to the pool of human germplasm that does result in the birth of an additional number of defective children. I have estimated that the amount of increase in the mutation rate as a result of radioactive fallout carried on at the present rate is 1%. Testing at the present rate leads to a 1% increase in mutation rate, a 1% increase in the number of defective children who will be born in the future.
Then in 1963, President John Kennedy, under tremendous public pressure to reduce radioactive fallout, proposed a cessation by the United States and the Soviet Union in nuclear weapons testing. So evolved the Limited Test Ban Treaty. Weapons testing went underground.
Towards freezing the world from the fears and dangers of radioactive fallout. Continued, unrestricted testing by the nuclear powers, joined in time by other nations, which may be less adept in limiting pollution, will increasingly contaminate the air that all of us must breathe. Even then, the number of children and grandchildren with cancer in their bones, with leukemia in their blood, or with poison in their lungs might seem statistically small to some in comparison with natural health hazards. But this is not a natural health hazard, and it is not a statistical issue. The loss of even one human life, or the malformation of even one baby, who may be born long after all of us have gone, should be of concern to us all.
You see, when President Kennedy stopped exploding nuclear weapons in the atmosphere, he did so because the mothers of America and the Soviet Union saw that their children were being killed with strontium 90.
Retired Admiral Gene LaRocque of the Washington-based Center for Defense Information.
And there was a hue and cry from particularly mothers that we want those nuclear weapons explosions stopped. They were stopped and put underground. Since they've been underground, the mothers have not been so interested anymore. People have almost forgotten about nuclear weapons testing. And if you want to bring about a change in a country like the United States, then the people must speak out. It's a little more subtle than having nuclear weapons exploding overhead, but it's equally as important to stop nuclear weapons testing underground as it was to stop explosions in the atmosphere.
I interviewed Bertrand Russell. I wish I'd interviewed Einstein, but it was too late. But in Russell's case, he was saying, and he said this many times, he's saying, he spoke of U.S., USSR, of course, the two antagonists, the two superpowers. He says, they have to realize that their common humanity is far transcends overwhelmingly their ideological differences. And he says it, and others say it in different forms. But this village is now smaller than ever, this global village we call the Earth. And what Martin Luther King did put it, we'll either live together as men or die together as fools. And it comes to that. It comes to idiocy or sanity. Einstein, come back to Einstein. We have to come back to Einstein because it was he who split the... It was he who came up with a theory that made all this possible. And it was he who saw President Franklin Roosevelt to get the okay for the Manhattan Project, who was horrified when the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. He never expected the bomb to be dropped on human beings. And toward the end, he said, we've got to think anew. And then think anew means think beyond, as he put it, you know, national boundaries and flags and martial music. Everything has changed. Nothing will ever be the same. We know that scientifically, technologically, we have taken the quantum leap. What he's really saying is we've got to take a quantum leap in thinking.
This program was produced and narrated by Andrew Phillips. Production assistance from Arlene Krebs and Amy Goodman. Technical production, Stephen Erickson and Peter Beauchamp. Special thanks, Stutz Terkel. This has been an Investigations radio project. This program was made available by the Center for Defense Information. CDI publishes the Defense Monitor, and its address is Box 141, Washington, D.C., 20044.